We're joined by Esmond Jenkins. He's a Lib Dem councillor from the Cotswolds. Esmond, we mentioned at the start that you got involved particularly with the problems of planning and development. So tell us when you first realised that that was a problem, because I understand you actually got elected on the back of doing something about what seemed to be corruption going on in the planning system, where an area in the Cotswold Water Park, beautiful area, is supposed to be a conservation area, and yet for some reason strange developments were popping up, actually multi-million pound developments.
Yeah, I mean, this has been going on since the early 1990s. Bear in mind, I only came to the area in 2004, and my specific interest to start with was just how this quarry had been manoeuvred into position.
So it started off as a kind of NIMBY thing. This was happening outside your
back
garden.
Yeah, unashamedly. The local population, in fact, a local landowner sort of came striding up to me with his walking stick and suggesting that a 6 foot high bund, earth bank, would be quite sufficient to protect us from the the dust and the noise and all the rest that goes with gravel extraction. My initial reaction was over my dead body. I hadn't travelled all the way from leafy Surrey to live next to a quarry. So that was a selfish motivation. But we started, typical of a lot of areas, there were retired professionals and lawyers and architects, and there was a willing team of people who, once alert to potential wrongdoing, galvanised very quickly.
Now, I understand the Water Park Society is a quango, sort of offshoot from the council, and that was running quite nicely, fairly nicely, chugging along, doing its job, conserving the water park. How did things go wrong and when?
Well, I mean, as with all these things, the society, the Water Park Society, was a quango set up by principally by Gloucestershire County Council to take charge of public administration in the Cotswold Water Park, which is an area of about 140 square miles, straddling Wiltshire and Gloucestershire. And it's basically the gravel beds surrounding the Upper Thames. And I think post-war gravel extraction had left areas of lakes with no apparent economic use and were just taken over by wildlife and nature. And it was out of that landscape that the Water Park Society was formed, funded by local authorities. And it was run by 10 or 15 very decent people drawn from the local society, local communities, with a very strict conservation mandate, and they set about the job very effectively. And I think it soon became apparent that to the commercial interests in the water park that some of the planning permissions were being obstructed by this new quango, and that was probably evident by the year 2000-2001.
So these developers, how did they manage to get round the system? I mean, obviously they've spent a bit of money and time on preparing a planning application. That's been kicked back. But then things started to happen, didn't they? I mean, we had the disposal of Kane's Country Park and also places like Summer Lake. Now, the thing is, for a house builder, this is absolutely a wonderful territory, isn't it? If you can build a luxury house next to a lake, you're going to sell it for a million, if not millions.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, look, you have to follow the money with these things. The one development, south of Cirencester, has permission for 600 holiday homes. Now, when the planning permission was originally conceived, this was to be 600 log cabins, small caravan-sized developments, but developers set to work and expanded the brief so that we ended up with individual properties worth £3 million, £4 million. Now, the mathematics suggests that even at £2 million or £1 million, 600 units, you're looking at perhaps £1 billion worth of development, £500 million worth of development. So huge sums of money are at stake, and with money comes influence, and with influence, developers do their utmost to win planning permissions.
Now, the fascinating thing is that this land, without the planning permission, is worth maybe a few £1,000 an acre. With the planning permission, it's worth millions an acre. So it's almost like a sort of money manufacturing machine.
Yeah, what you've got to understand is, first off, if you can win a gravel extraction license or planning permission, you can convert what is now probably £4,000 or £5,000 an acre agricultural land to £300,000 to £500,000 per acre in terms of value as a site for mineral extraction. Once you've dug your hole, you can earn another £300,000 or £500,000 from infilling that hole with waste. Once you've completed that exercise, you can then sell it for £300,000 or £400,000 as a brownfield site to developers. Now, the only thing to stopping you converting £4,000 an acre agricultural land to a multi-million pound return is two or three planning permissions.
Wow, amazing. So this is the local authority that's giving these planning. But, I mean, a lot of this has been covered in bits and pieces in Private Eye over the last, 5 years or so, and also in the Daily Telegraph. Tell us about some of the coverage you've got.
Yeah, I mean, this is apparently, after the Poulsen affair in the 1970s, this is the longest running article in or coverage that Private Eye have ever run. And it's been known, and it's echoed around Westminster and the House of Lords, because it's a real insight to just how, in my opinion, corruption extends into a local authority, which on the surface looks very respectable. But once you start to lift the veneer of respectability, you start to understand what's really going on.
So how do just maybe one or two people, individual councillors on a planning committee, how do they actually control the committee? Because, I mean, one of the things that you've discovered is that it's not necessarily a majority of people on that planning committee. It's just one or two influential people there can actually get one of these planning decisions overturned.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, coming from a commercial background, and this is the, I think, why we've been so successful and so tenacious, is that people coming from a business background, sitting in on local authority committees, very quickly worked out that, you know, a 25-man committee can be dominated by one, two, or three people. Similarly, a 15-man or a 12-man planning committee can be dominated by two, three people. Once you understand and you watch a few of these, then you can see who the heavyweights are. And then what became apparent to us was that some of those heavyweights are very closely connected to the big commercial interests in the water park.
Fascinating. But are you saying that most of the people sitting around that planning committee table are like drones, just following the lead of some powerful people on the committee?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably true of councils up and down the country, regardless of political colour. Local politics is tribal, and what I've seen, certainly in my own council, is that, you know, a lot of power is concentrated in two, three, or four people.
So what connections did you find between these powerful people on the committees and the developers? And you managed to make some links, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, the leader of Cotswold District Council, and is still a chap called Lyndon Stowe, and there's his business partner, David Fowles. They ran a printing organisation.
But hang on, David, isn't he a councillor too?
David Fowles is a councillor. Both of them were in business, plying their trade, selling printing and media coverage to these major developers, and in particular the holiday home developers. That was one element, but they were also in business with Dennis Grant, the guy who went to jail for 4 years for fraud and theft of over a million pounds of assets of the Cotswold Water Park.
Crikey, well, tell us about that, because I know he's just about to come out of jail, isn't he?
He's been out for a couple of weeks as far as we know.
Okay, but, how did that case come about?
Well, very early on in 2008, this guy had, he started in 2006. He took over, he was invited to take over the Cotswold Water Park Society, which was the local authority-sponsored quango, and very quickly set about transforming the way it did its business. And I think for those of us who were perhaps more sceptical of his motives, it became apparent that this guy was somebody who had very little interest in conservation and a great deal of interest in his own personal enrichment. And he was he openly courted commercial relationships with the big money men in the water park. These are the gravel digging companies and the after-use holiday home developers.
Okay, so what was he actually finally prosecuted for? Because I know that there are various potential things that people could be criminal offences. I mean, one is misconduct in public office, another is fraud or theft, and conspiracy, which is when various people get together to plan these frauds or theft of public land, public assets. What was he actually finally convicted for?
Yeah, well, I think that this is the essence of the water park scandal, is that this guy was benefiting, taking very large commissions from selling off taxpayer-owned assets.
He was in his own pocket, personally, or his own business? Or?
Yeah, no. I mean, he organised the 114-year lease of the county council-owned Keynes Country Park to the developer for £1 a year, and he personally took a commission of £165,000 for that. There was the Water Park Society's own Gateway Centre, which is a very nice oak frame building built in 2002 at the entrance to the water park. He sold off for £1.8 million. And pocketed £400,000 for that. And there were other commissions. There was another sum which he took as £150,000, which was basically his undoing, which he took as a backhander from a developer for exclusive development rights around another lake.
Now he's gone to jail. Does that mean that the corruption is over at the water park?
No, well, it depends on who you speak to, but it was always my view that Dennis Grant was only part of the problem. People shouldn't have been conned that the fraud started and stopped with Dennis Grant. He facilitated a number of deals, but the beneficiaries were ultimately the one of the major principal beneficiaries was the largest holiday home developer, second home developer in the water park.
Now, obviously, the police got him, but what about other police investigations, audits and ombudsman, that kind of thing? What's been going on? How many inquiries and what inquiries into what's happened?
In the first instance, we call the audit commission in because we were not happy at the way county council officials had handled the disposal of Keynes Country Park. It just didn't make sense to us. That audit commission report was pulled up prematurely when somebody made the decision that they'd close the accounts for 2007 and therefore were not prepared to continue. We then went to the local government ombudsman. That investigation was running for about 18 months and I think the watershed moment was March 2010 when I organised a public meeting which included our MP in a packed village hall, 350 people with television cameras and radio stations and local press there, and we had discovered £150,000 backhander which the Dennis Grant and his water park society couldn't explain. And it was 4 weeks after that that Dennis Grant was arrested. And then his sidekick, a guy called Nick Hansen, who was his finance director, he dropped dead with a heart attack when he was arrested.
Now, I know he's not the only person to have died who's been involved in this investigation.
No, I mean, the water park scandal, I think, has sadly taken a number of lives. There's been a lot of stress and a lot of pressure on a lot of people.
And the journalist who was working with you on the Private Eye stories, just tell us a bit about him.
Yeah, well, he was a chap called Declan Cunningham, who wasn't a member of any political party, but joined with us in 2008 and offered his services to me as a PR man and as a journalist, and he was a very skilled one at that. And it was Declan that used to do a lot of the narratives which ended up in Private Eye covertly. I mean, that's never been made public knowledge, but I'm sure his family wouldn't, now he's gone, will not mind.
Also, yourself, you were subjected to what can really only be called bullying and harassment. I mean, just tell us about that. I mean, trying to get you dismissed as a counsellor.
Yeah, I mean, I think you become, I've become very sceptical about local politics as a result of my experiences. But bear in mind that the arrest of Dennis Grant was in April 2010, and by the end of 2010, the police had wound down their investigation into wrongdoing in the water park, and they decided that it was merely fraud and theft, i.e. that Dennis Grant had stolen from his employer. And it was always my point that that couldn't have been the case. Nevertheless, by 2011, early 2011, to all observers, the police had no longer any interest in the water park. In February 2011, there was a development at Keynes Country Park which involved fleets of lorries bringing in infill from places as far afield as Bristol and Reading, to fill in one of the conservation, the nature reserves on at the lakes. It was called Lake 31 at Keynes Park, which met with outrage from local people because there was no planning permission for this. And when we raised it with the local authority, the planning department didn't want to know, nor did David Newdegg, the chief executive of Cotswold District Council, nor did his auditor, and neither did the police when we alerted them. So eventually in February, I arranged for a senior officer of Cotswold District Council to attend the site so that we could measure the extent of the infill, which was causing so much local concern. What happened was little short of a Andrew Mitchell style stitch up, because I was accused of abusive language and threatening behaviour. That evening, a police officer phoned me up and announced that a complaint had been made that I had used threatening behaviour, which I denied. And when I pointed out that actually there were two parish councillors with me who would attest to what went on, the police action was dropped. However, what continued was a Standards Board for England complaint raised by the developer Max Thomas with the support of an enforcement officer from the Environment Agency, this being the enforcement officer responsible in theory to prevent any illegal infilling of the many lakes in the water park.
It sounds all a little bit perverse, that, because there you are explaining that the environment is being abused, and then you've got the Environment Agency actually backing a complaint against you.
Well, more specifically, the Environment, just to put it into context, the developer Max Thomas and his Watermark group, who'd got hold of the lake courtesy of the jailed fraudster, had a permission to remodel the banks of this nature reserve, Lake 31, which by a surveyor's calculation should have required no more than 5,000 tonnes of earth being brought in. What the council eventually had to admit was that in excess of 40,000 tonnes of earth had been brought in. Now, for those who know anything about the infilling or landfilling, lorries, a lorry load of infill taken to a landfill site will attract significant sums of tax and is an expensive option for a developer. So the dumping of earth from 20 ton lorries reputedly attracts £100-200 payment each time, and we calculated that the developer who'd undertaken the illicit infill had benefited to the tune of £500,000. Nevertheless, I raised this upon the request of local authority of local parishes, and then I found myself facing a standard board's complaint, which is a very serious complaint of bullying and abusive language, and bringing my position into disrepute.
BCFM. Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Their goal is to destroy all existing religions save theirs, all existing governments save theirs, and shackle the mob in a system of eternal oppressive debt chained to a computer for the rest of their life, in a propagandized world to make them believe that they are happy in this system.
We start where we left off, that is with Liberal Democrat councillor in the Cotswolds, Esmond Jenkins. Now, Esmond, we were just getting into some of the issues affecting you personally, but tell us a little bit about the whole process of the auditing, because this is where these things are supposed to be picked up. When things go wrong, surely the auditors are supposed to come in, aren't they, and have a look through the books and say, well, this didn't work and that didn't work. How what was your experience of whether the auditors actually did their job or not?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, we've had seven investigations, and I think the first audit commission inquiry was in 2008. It raised some valid questions, didn't get proper answers from very senior managers at the county council, but was pulled up. In 2010, after the fraud had broken the surface and the chief executive of Cotswold District Council announced a independent review of the water park and launched the council's own audit team under the direction of Robert Milford to look at every aspect of the Cotswold water park scandal and how it impinged upon the council. And at the outset, I was supposed to help him set the brief because I was the one councillor who had been instrumental in exposing the fraud in the water park. And I'd raised concerns over the business dealings and the business relationships between colleagues in the council and those who were closely connected to the fraud in the water park. So that was my expectation. As it was, I was never actually called by the auditor to help him set the brief. And then it transpired, surprise, surprise, that actually the auditor hadn't looked at the Conservative councillors who I had concerns about. What he'd had done was look at 400 plus emails of mine to the chief executive officer, the CEO, and the leader of the council, and it was his evidence that helped to substantiate a disciplinary complaint against me.
So that sounds a bit strange. People actually doing the investigating weren't actually started to not focus on what they were supposed to be investigating, but look at you instead. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, it's a pretty incredible tale we've heard here from Esmond over what is actually a very important natural resource, something that we would expect that our local authorities looking after. They're clearly not.
Well, yes, I mean, obviously the detail has been fascinating, but what strikes me is the possibility that this isn't just a one-off fraud, but that the failures to investigate run, you know, through the police force and possibly in directions like that. So we're not just talking about a particular case. It may be that it's exposed failings in the whole system of making sure that planning is done properly and transparently.
Now, I know one of the connections between all sorts of people in public life, and including the police, city councillors, council officers, county councillors, etc., is Freemasonry. A lot of them are in the same lodges. Have you actually found any evidence that of involvement through Freemasonry, where somebody may be benefiting, and also know someone else in their own lodge who was involved in potentially investigating this?
The issue of Freemasonry, it really underpins the whole water park scandal. In 2008, before I became, it was just after I'd been elected as a councillor, I had a meeting in the council buildings, and a very senior officer agreed with me that the council knew they had a problem with Freemasonry. That was a private conversation I had with him. But he subsequently denied making those claims. What I would say is that something has to be linking local authorities, the commercial interests in the water park, the planning process, and latterly the police. Something has to tie.
But I mean, isn't it possible that this is just conversations had down the pub saying, well, I'm a friend of yours, I can fix this for you? I mean, it doesn't have to be Freemasonry, surely. It doesn't have to be involved at all.
No, but it could be any number of associations. But there is, I would argue, if you look at the Serious Fraud Office's website and you start, one of the key telltales of fraud and corruption is when decisions start to cease to follow any logic. You know, irrational decisions are made at various levels. And the whole story of the Cotswold Water Park scandal is the systemic failure of local authority officers to do anything about it. And when they are challenged, they simply deny any knowledge when the evidence suggests otherwise. This was why we brought in the police. I raised the second complaint that Gloucestershire Police Force had not conducted anything approaching a rigorous investigation in 2010. They had a four-week review. They agreed with me, and they brought in the City of London Police. That was a further 15-month police investigation, which I've got to say, at the end of which, I don't think was any more rigorous than the first one. I think senior police officers have been very careful in focusing the investigation off-centre to make sure that those in positions of political power and influence have not come under any suspicion.
So, but have you actually any evidence whatsoever that Freemasons are involved?
Well,
had any testimony from anybody, for example?
Only from local people. We know people who've worked for various individuals who say yes, he's a Freemason. You know, before I became well known in the water park, shaking hands with people is a reasonable telltale of where they are, and then observing the linkages between individuals at the in public meetings, I think, is another who comes in to help who. Something, whether it's Freemasonry or some other connection, something has to explain the systemic failure of investigation after investigation to point to the complicity of local authority officials. Which,
well, it's interesting, Martin, bringing in the City of London Police to investigate this, because they're almost like their own sort of separate jurisdiction, and they don't really seem to have done very well when it comes to investigating crimes happening in the city. For example, LIBOR fraud. We've had more recently the problems with foreign exchange fraud. We have payment protection insurance fraud. We've also had vast amounts of money laundering going on by banks in the city. And the City of London Police seem to have been very, very relaxed with their handcuffs.
Well, I don't know enough to make a solid comment about this, but I think what the patterns are becoming increasingly clear when you look at local level with a relatively small level of corruption in the water park, relatively small. Of course, for the local people, that's a big issue. But I think what's really happening is that we've got a deregulated environment now for this kind of behaviour, and we've reached a point with the City of London, the city as an institution, where if they start prosecuting individuals, they'll have to prosecute everybody. They can't prosecute everybody, so they don't prosecute anybody. And the senior economists in the US are saying that they're expecting thousands of people to be sent to prison. That hasn't happened. That's what happened in the 1980s, the savings and loan scandal. The Icelanders have sent their bankers to prison this week. If it doesn't happen, something's amiss. It should happen.
Author Martin Short, journalist Martin Short, used to work on World in Action, the defunct Granada TV documentary series, and he wrote a book called Inside the Brotherhood. Here he is talking about police and the City of London and their involvement with Freemasonry.
I don't want to give the impression that however many Freemasons there are in this country now, or a good deal less than it used to be, that they're all policemen. In fact, Freemasonry is full of people in many walks of life, and also, by and large, these days dedicated lodges for police officers would not be encouraged, though there is in fact one called the St. James's Lodge in central London, which is entirely staffed by police officers. However, in an average lodge, you might get people from any walk of life, and in among them might be a police officer. Now, it would be a sore temptation, bearing in mind the oaths of mutual defence and support that Freemasons undertake, if you were in trouble, whether it's over a parking ticket or a drunken driving offence or, some punch up with a neighbour, that you might hope that you could turn to a brother as a Mason in distress, and favours would follow, that maybe bits of paper could be lost and you could avoid prosecution. I think that's a bit more difficult these days, but of course what used to be common practice, you can't be absolutely sure doesn't happen now.
What about the City of London? Because I know back in the 1980s you had a good look at the death of the banker Roberto Calvi. Now, a lot of people now are looking at the City of London and thinking, can we trust the banking fraternities, and can we trust these big investment banks that seem to have such a lot of power over our futures at the moment?
There is absolutely no doubt that Freemasonry used to be extremely strong in the City of London. We obtained a lodge list of all the Lord Mayor's Lodge in London, and universally, one after another, over about 70 years, the Lord Mayors of London were masters of this lodge. In fact, some of them were initiated only after they had become Lord Mayor. Unfortunately, I haven't been blessed by being handed another copy of the Guildhall Lodge members list.
That was author and journalist Martin Short there. He was his book, very well worth reading, is Inside the Brotherhood, about Freemasonry. Now I'm joined by Esmond Jenkins-Still, the Lib Dem councillor in the Cotswolds. Now, Esmond, I know that as part of the police investigation, you actually put in your witness statement the names of 10 council officers and individual councillors that you believed you had reason to believe, either evidence from elsewhere or handshaking, this kind of thing, that were actually Freemasons. What happened? Did the police investigate to see whether those people were in similar lodges, knew each other through Freemasonry and had some kind of connection outside their official office?
No, I mean, this goes back to September 2011 when I was invited to a meeting at Gloucestershire Police Headquarters by Kevin Lambert, who was one of the Assistant Chief Police Officers. And he listened, to my concerns over the first round police investigation. And it was to Kevin Lambert that I said, look, it's my belief that Freemasonry is at work, in some form. I drew the observation or drip on the observation that the Cotswold Water Butt is basically a mining area. It's a quarrying area. And Cirencester had five lodges. It's well known as being a centre historically of Freemasonry, and that Freemasonry is very much centred on the quarrying activity post-war. So observations and challenges which I'd made, because I went into meetings with statutory declarations. I challenged a number of senior county councillors who they wouldn't deny it or confirm it. But they certainly would not agree to signing a statutory declaration declaring whether they were or weren't Freemasons. So, you know, I'd just like to emphasise, you know, historically my family were Freemasons, so this is not something that I'm not, my father wasn't, but I don't believe all Freemasons are wicked or corrupt. But something has to explain the systemic failure to get to the truth of what really went on. Who was involved behind and in addition to Dennis Grant in the water park? Because it conceivably couldn't be just one person. It had to involve far more influential characters.
No, you've drawn yourself parallels with things like the Hillsborough cover-up. I mean, how do you justify that?
Yeah. Now, look, I've had pretty forthright meetings, long meetings with very senior police officers, and I've been abused verbally by them. They've tried to basically shut me up, and I've said no. Look, what we've embarked upon, what we've tried to expose in the water park, is systemic corruption. And the one observation I do make is that people in authority, supposedly respectable people, knights of the realm included, have turned a blind eye. They've walked past on the other side of the street. And that, I think, is probably the one thing that I will take to my grave. That, I've said quite openly and directly to this police officer, that if we cannot trust them, if they operate an a la carte justice system locally in Gloucestershire, they chase after some people but not others, depending on their associations, then that isn't justice at all, and that is a fast route for police to lose the respect and the trust of the community. And I think that's where we are.
But I mean, isn't it the situation that rich people, powerful people, organised criminals, for example, will always want to be in the police, be friendly to the police, and be influencing them?
Well, Savile probably tells us that. I mean, you drew upon the Hillsborough example, and I think that is a very powerful example, because, you know, from what I've learned, because I come from Liverpool originally, I know something of the outrage that people felt that the system had failed them. And eventually, the only route to justice was for the victims and the family of the victims to appoint their own investigation team. And it was only then, led by the Bishop of Liverpool and not police officers, that the truth was unearthed. And I think I've used that example and I've hammered it back to Gloucestershire Police that, you know, I don't think informed people do or can trust the police. I think the Mitchell affair and the Leveson inquiry all point to the same suspicions.
So, as someone who's been to hell and back with this story, obviously it still occupies quite a lot of your time, a great deal of courage to continue taking it on and not to do what these various people are trying to persuade you to do and just back off and forget about it. What advice would you have for changes that would actually bring about a much better system and actually to get justice in these cases? Are there any sort of tweaks that you'd like to see system to actually make sure that the police are doing their jobs in cases like this?
My observation and my comment, certainly in a relatively middle class area such as the Cotswold District, is that people are far too trusting. They're too trusting and they're too disinterested in the local authority system. you vote for people according to the colour of their the flag that they fly under. That is not the right way. We should, the one thing I've learned from all of this is that, you know, I'm not really interested in people's politics. I'm interested in the person. If I can trust that person, I can live with the politics. And you know, there are too many people in positions of responsibility who receive very handsome salaries from the taxpayer who simply have not done the job. Some of them have gone further. Some of them, I believe, were party to setting me up for this disciplinary process. So, you know, I would say to electorates, get involved, ask questions, and vote for people who you feel you can trust in. Don't vote for people simply because they represent one party or another. And then beyond that, I would say, as somebody a very senior Conservative in Oxfordshire once said to me quite recently, that the whole commissioner process was not something that he believed in, but the Andrew Mitchell debacle proves that the police left to their own devices can't be trusted. And I've got to say, as somebody who would have been on the opposite side of the fence 5 years ago, I believe that concern is absolutely valid. And I think, you know, senior police officers are politicised, they are career driven, and, you know, do they tell the truth? Well, frankly, not enough. So, I think what we need are more people to stand up and challenge.
And how do we ensure that our police services, that there isn't this kind of a temptation for people at senior levels in the police service to turn a blind eye to things?
Well, I don't think there's an easy solution. I think I've wasted huge amounts of time and large sums of money trying to do the job of other people. I've gone to the police twice, and I think we've drawn a blank twice, not because there isn't sufficient evidence, but because whoever's pulling the strings at Gloucestershire Police doesn't want the real culprits exposed. You know, whether that's Freemasonry or political allegiance or some other motivation, I don't know. But I know that there is evidence of bribery and corruption in the water park, and it's centred on the planning process, and yet nobody's been brought to account.
And for anybody that's also suspicious about planning decisions, is there anything that you could say that would help them to figure out whether there is corruption involved or not?
Yeah, I mean, you have to. I mean, I had the advantage. I wasn't working as a lawyer, so I could spend time sitting in local authority meetings and watching how they work. And I would encourage people at all levels, at all ages, the younger the better, to get it, you know, get in there, look how dysfunctional they are, and you'll see how they work, and ask questions, because the one thing that has helped us has been publicity. The people who are up to these up to skullduggery do not like the spotlight being turned on them, and that is the power ultimately of the press, and particularly of the private eye, because it is widely read. But it's publicity which is, I think, the weapon of choice. And to do that, you need to be prepared to engage, find out, and take a stand.
Well, Lib Dem councillor Esmond Jenkins from over in the Cotswolds. A fascinating insight into some of the corruption going on. In fact, as we heard, the biggest case dealt with by Private Eye since the Paulson affair. And we're going to finish with a listen now to an explanation by Martin Short. What is Freemasonry?
Much is made of the fact Rudyard Kipling and his lodge in India was ecumenical. People from any religion could join. Christian, Muslim, Jew, Sikh, Zoroastrian, anyway. Anyone who believed in a single God, you see, the only stipulation was it should be monotheistic. But once you get above the third degree, it's all Christian in a kind of perverse form. It's all fictive. It's all a miasma of legend and lies, you know. And it's like a pyramid sales operation, Freemasonry, because you have to keep on going up all these ranks in the hope that one day you will find the secret, the absolute kernel secret of Freemasonry. But as we've seen, they change the actual, you know, magic word. The words that you're told up to a certain level are the secret words of the signs of Freemasonry. You're told, oh, no, it's not like that at all. You know, you've been led down the garden path. I mean, it is a bit like a pyramid sales operation. And, of course, it does cost you a huge amount of money.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.